Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to begin with a shorter rendition today than normal of our health and nutrition and anti-aging segments. And that's because I'm very concerned about the new G5 technology. Most people only look at what they're told as a benefit. It'll get you a call quicker. You'll have more power. There'll be less places that you cannot access. So they're looking at all the wonderful qualities of life that you can gain. The trouble is, that's only a small part of the story. When you hear from the experts on today's program, three separate segments on this dangerous technology, you'll think, wow, why hasn't the media been covering this? This is a very important story and could be doing more damage to our health than any other single environmental pollutant that there is, electromagnetic pulses. Now, we've been on this for a long time. I remember 10 years ago, I helped lead a demonstration on the Upper West Side on West End Avenue where the building had the cell phone tower on the building, and people were complaining in the building about headaches and other fatigue and sleep disturbance patterns. And we said, let's take this message nationwide. You will not believe how many scientific studies exist today showing that these electromagnetic pulses from your computer, from your laptop, from your cell phone, and even when you're in your car, you're getting it all the time, that these are extremely deleterious. So that's the bulk of what we're going to talk about with the experts. But then, in fairness, the person who is the number one promoter of this technology in the United States is just a recently retired head of the Federal Communications Commission. And he is a major proponent, and he's very articulate. He presents a very good case. The trouble is, he was the former chief lobbyist for the top two wireless companies in the United States. So he had a gross conflict of interest. And the new person taking his place has the same. They are coming from an industry to promote the agenda of the industry without considering safety. Oh, and by the way, which agency handles the health of all the cell phones and the Wi-Fis? It's not the FDA. It's not the National Academy of Science Overview. No, it's the Federal Communications Commission. So the very people who want you to have this technology, and you'll hear him say, this is going to make us billions of dollars, probably hundreds of billions. He's saying how safe it is. So it's not. So that's a big deal. At the same time, following that, we'll take a break and come back. Part one of a five-part series on who are the most powerful people in the world when it comes to our future. Well, they're the very same people who controlled our past. So we're going to give you a history lesson today about the truth of who built American economies and the banking system and the big monopolies, and the descendants, their heirs, and people they hand-selected are in power today. What's their agenda? And then you'll see their agenda. Now, you're only being told one part of the story, that, wow, we need to do more genetic engineering research because think of the people with different inherited diseases that are going to suffer, but we can block that, we can change it, we can alter their DNA. That's true. And I would certainly support that. Any reasonable person would if you could eliminate disease. But that's not the reason they want this. Not at all. So you're going to end up with a super class of people in the future, the immediate future. I'm not talking about 25 years from now. I'm talking about now. You also see that everything that they have been planning as a, well, almost a utopian way of living, it's here now. And you'd think that people would wake up. If they're saying, look, you need more leisure time, well, that's true. But we're going to create these virtual reality headsets. They have them now. They've been around for 10 years. But the new ones are really cool. You can sit at your desk or on a sofa, and you put this on, and wherever you want to go in the world and whatever you want to do, it's already pre-planned in there. So you are now in your own world. What about the jobs I used to have? Oh, robotics have taken those over. What about my computer skills? And I was an IT person. Oh, all IT people are now redundant because we have artificial intelligence that actually can program itself. Do you think that's science fiction? That actually exists right now, today. They've actually created the most advanced type of artificial intelligence that can actually create its own language. Well, what possibly could go wrong with that? We'll see. So this begins a five-part series. You have not heard any of this. You haven't seen it. You haven't read it. And unless you're a really diligent scholar on the topic, you wouldn't even know it exists. So we're going to bring it to you. So my suggestion is call your friends, because what you're going to hear today, you have never heard, you won't hear, and it won't be heard anywhere else. Now let's begin with health and nutrition, which we do every day. From the University of Illinois, a study that shows that a mother's diet during pregnancy, particularly one that is high fat, can actually genetically program her baby to be at risk of diabetes. Now, a lot of women, when they're pregnant, they're told, well, you're hungry, eat for two. And you shouldn't, because there's not two of you. There's a big you, and there's a little tiny baby, 6 pounds, 8 pounds. But people are packing on a lot of excess weight, and almost all of that is from empty calories and highly inflammatory input. So that ends up changing the DNA, so now your baby ends up with a proclivity to being overweight. And this was published in the Epigenomics, where you got to get into a healthy diet. Now, here's the good news. If you've been in a bad diet, where you've eaten ice cream or dairy or cheese because you were told it was all right, you can actually change the DNA sequencing back again if you go on a really strict, healthy, organic, plant-based diet with lots of green juices. Because those green juices, the chlorophyll, the chlorella, the spirulina, the wheatgrass juice, all of those green juices taken 3 or 4 times a day can create a whole new set of the immature stem cells that can then be used in different parts of the body to rejuvenate them. And that's one of the reasons when people do a detox and rejuvenation, they literally rejuvenate. I'm right now, today's the last day of the retreat for those that were in here because they were supporting WBAI, our sister station, and we're happy to say that the results have been just spectacular. But there's another group here that's a study group. It's different. They have their own place here to do exercises and watch films and journaling, and they have a very intense juicing protocol. I've seen things that I didn't think were possible in what will be, by the end of next week when it finishes, 28-day program. Now, it was 5 years ago that I did a 28-day program with arthritis. And to get into that study, you had to have arthritis for at least 7 years, be under medical treatment and taking drugs, generally what are called the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And we had a packed house. Over 300 people began that study. And it was just diet, detoxification, lifestyle, behavior modification, and exercise. With 28 days, for those who stuck protocol, there was a 92% relieving all arthritis pain and stiffness. In fact, one man on the final night, and we filmed it, by the way, before and after. One man said that he was having an awful lot of trouble coming down the hill to get to the lecture space on 92nd and 2nd, because the hill was very steep and he had to go very slow because his knees were just solidified. He couldn't move them. And then when he got up the steps, he had to take his time lifting one leg up, then the other leg up. And on the last night, 28 days later, he said, I bounded down the hill almost in a gallop. I felt so free, no pain and full mobility. I bounded right up the steps when I got here. And then he did a little half squat and raised his leg. He said, I couldn't have done any of this. I couldn't tie my shoelaces. I couldn't bend over and put on my socks. So, okay, we published the results. It was the first study of its kind, a clinical study, that showed that you can change the outcome of a common illness, which is arthritis. So then the question is, what could you do with someone with advanced Alzheimer's who's 93, for example? As of this morning, that gentleman with his wife, and to appreciate this, and I filmed it, by the way, you have to see him in his first day. He had that Alzheimer's stare, just staring off into space. You ask him a question, his eyes didn't come in contact with you, very slow, and he might answer, but he'd answer a different answer than the question you asked him. And he had a cane, and he was wobbly and didn't have balance. Well, this morning when I walked out, we were going for a power walk. I said, how are you feeling? He said, I'm into this thing. He said, no cane, walking 3 miles, working out in the gym. I do the rope thing where you put a rope, one of those big, thick ropes in each hand, and you're flipping it up and back. And he said, never did that before. And he said, and I got my humor back, finding everything funny. And indeed, people were saying, this guy's very funny. And his wife said, I got my husband back. He was gone. He's back. So remember, all it takes is to do something once to prove that it can be done. You don't have to do it 1,000 times. Then it's up for other people. What you do is you do your study. You give an outside independent scientific biostatistician the raw information, the medical records, the blood workups, whatever you're measuring. They do a write-up on it. Then you get it published, hopefully in a peer-reviewed journal. Then other people in the health field can take that protocol and should, using the same identical protocol, come up with the same or similar results. And so that's the goal. So good news out there for those of you who have memory loss, Alzheimer's, even advanced Alzheimer's. And also good news for you who have advanced multiple sclerosis, because the person who's here with multiple sclerosis is making enormous changes. And again, this is not medical. This is purely lifestyle. So more on that at the end of next week, when they'll all be coming on the radio just to, in their own words, say what they experienced. Because if it can be done here as an example, then it can be done anywhere. That's why I say, give me one block in the worst neighborhood, in the worst rundown, crime-ridden city in America. And then let's see what can be done with the resources, the human resources of the community, and then look at that as a model and measure it and be critical of that measurement for a year. And then if it works and you reduce crime and violence and addiction and gang membership, and you get people happy and community-oriented again and coming out of their houses, and you've built something right in the middle of that, then you could use that for every community in America. So that's the idea. Anyhow, that's good. Now, magnesium is a very underutilized and frequently deficient mineral, a macro mineral, meaning we need it in large milligrams, ideally around 800 milligrams a day, and balanced also with calcium. Well, unfortunately, a lot of Americans end up with colorectal cancer, 51,000 in one recent year, and breast cancer claimed over 41,000 lives in the same year. Now, recent research, according to Natural Health 365, has shown that a common, inexpensive mineral, magnesium, can play a role in suppressing cellular changes that can precede the development of these types of cancer. Now, this news ought to inject a note of hope into the ongoing search for natural cancer prevention and treatment strategies. And Because why? Magnesium mimics the life-prolonging effects of calorie restriction. And that's very important because extensive studies have shown that caloric restriction, lowering the calories each day, absolutely slows down biological aging and prevents disease and extends life. So get your magnesium for all the right reasons, including preventing cancers. And finally, 1 to 10 mutations are needed to drive cancer. This is according to the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute. It's a little complicated. This was published in Cell, and I always give the publication in case someone wants to do their own research and take something further if it interests them. So for the first time, scientists have provided unbiased estimates of the number of mutations needed for cancers to develop. In a study of more than 7,500 tumors across 29 cancer types, and researchers from the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute and their collaborators adopted a technique from the field of evolution to confirm that on average, 1 to 10 driver mutations are needed for cancer to emerge. And in the study, the team developed an approach to discovering which genes are implicated in cancer evolution and how many mutations in those genes drive cancer. So it's a very important study. But here's what they didn't say, and here's what you, I'm sure, already know. In a given day, of our anywhere from 50 to 100 trillion cells, and 10 times that amount in bacteria, we are seeing an assault against each and every one of those cells, about 10,000 gene alterations per day per cell. That means that each cell in your body is affected about 10,000 times a day. That's mainly from free radicals that are produced in massive amounts from oxidative stress. For example, the more you exercise, the more free radicals you create. Now, you've heard me say many times it's a balancing act. On the one hand, you want the benefits of exercise, burning fat, creating more lean muscle tissue, promoting human growth hormone, better digestion, the important hormones, the feel-good hormones that are created from about a half hour of aerobic exercise will allow you to feel good, the endorphins for about the next natural opiates for about the next 6 hours. So if you exercise in the morning and evening, you've got about 12 hours of feel-good hormones cascading through your body. Plus, you're going to be leaner, have less body mass index or less fat, especially abdominal fat, and hence you're going to be less susceptible to diabetes, cancer, and heart disease and high blood pressure. All good. But here's the big thing. You also have that will help balance the oxidative stress. You premature age the cell because you're producing so many free radicals. So if you take your vitamin C and magnesium and cayenne and coenzyme Q10 and L-carnitine, when you go for a workout or when you return, you've neutralized the negative and you've accented the positive. That's what should happen. So now we know that by having a plant-based healthy diet with juices, your cells are not going to be adversely affected 10,000 times per cell per day. It'll be 1/100th of that. And then with the nutrients and herbs we know that can actually go in and repair the cell, NAD, PPQ, pycnogenol, and also resveratrol, L-carnosine, we can actually even improve that. So if someone came to me and said, oh, gee, Gary, I just tested, and even though there's no cancer in my family, I tested positive for the cancer gene, I would immediately say, don't be concerned. Remember, that is just a construct. You can actually change the genetic disposition of the gene by repairing the damage and preventing cancer. So that's the good news on that. So even though they've made strides in showing how many mutations it takes before a cancer gene becomes cancerous, no one's going to pay attention to that because we do so many things that causes gene mutations. Alcohol, sugar, fried foods, excessive calories, sedentary activity, stress, hormones affects us. So why not just get rid of all that and just do the right thing? Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Now we're going into an in-depth discussion on the dangers of the new G5 technology. Please listen.
So hi, my name is Kevin Modis. I'm with the California Brain Tumor Association, but I actually collaborate with 10 other groups. One of the groups is emfscientist.org, emfscientist.org. That's 220 doctors and scientists from 39 countries who have looked at health effects from wireless radiation. And from their work and the work of others, we can clearly say that wireless radiation can cause cancer, neurological problems, immune system disorders, and reproductive harm. Clearly, our scientists, along with the other groups I work with, which are composed of people who are developing wireless health effects from their various sources. For instance, people developing brain tumors from their cell phone and the radiation emits. People developing neurological symptoms from the Wi-Fi, from school Wi-Fi. People developing neurological and cancerous health effects from simple smart meters. Smart meters being little wireless meters that are put on people's homes so that people don't have to come by and read the meter themselves manually. So regardless of the source, and cell towers are the most powerful source of wireless radiation emissions, regardless of the source, the health effects can be the same. So what brings me here today is the rollout of 5G technology. And people need to understand that 5G technology is very different from 2G, 3G, and 4G that preceded it. And that is because the wireless radiation is using a higher frequency. Our current wireless technology uses about 1 gigahertz to 4 gigahertz. This new 5G technology is ultra high frequency, ultra high intensity, and it's 24 gigahertz to 90 gigahertz. To put this in some type of perspective, 90 gigahertz is 90 billion electromagnetic waves per second hitting your body. We know people are already getting sick from the lower frequencies, and we expect, that is our scientists expect, that these higher, ultra-high frequency microwaves are going to bring people to disease quicker and in a more intense form. The other problem with 5G technology is these microwaves are very short. So our old microwaves were about 2.5 to 3 feet long. These are now about 1 inch to 1/2 inch long. And they don't travel very well. So they're going to have to put a little cell tower transmitter in front of about every 2 to 10 homes. Now, this is a big problem because we know that cancer rates around regular cell towers are about 3 or 4 times what they normally should be. We also know that there's neurological symptoms that increase as you get closer and closer to a cell tower. Now, these new transmitters are going to be placed close to people's homes. It's going to be continuous exposure, as with other cell towers, but it'll be emitting a much more higher frequency, high intensity wireless radiation. So we have a tremendous problem that's happening, and people need to understand that the FCC is pushing this technology nationwide. What's also important for people to understand is the FCC is dominated by the wireless industry itself. And the FCC are the people that are given the responsibility and privilege of regulating wireless radiation human exposure standards. So, unfortunately, the FCC, whose chairman, who just left, and they change with every administration, was the former main lobbyist and the former president of the Wireless Trade Organization, CTIA. So the agency that's been given the responsibility and privilege of maintaining and setting our human exposure standards for wireless radiation, and people call this radio frequency radiation or EMF, electromagnetic field radiation, they all mean the same thing, are the people who profit and benefit from the proliferation of wireless technology and the transmitters that empower it. So we have a huge conflict of interest at the top. And this is what really drives and creates the problem from the beginning. Actually, the EPA used to look at this this area, had their own scientists assigned to studying it, and showed just what we're seeing, that wireless radiation can increase cancer, neurological problems, reproductive harm, and immune system problems. They actually proposed a standard that was thermal and non-thermal. What we have now is an FCC that has set a thermal standard. The problem with that is it misses what happens non-thermally or sub-thermally. And what our scientists can show and prove is that wireless radiation can damage cells and damage our DNA, leading to cancer and other serious pathologies below thermal. So we have the FCC setting a standard that really avoids the problem. This is a big problem because whenever they roll out a new wireless technology, whenever they're questioned about the safety of it, and people need to understand there are more than 10,000 studies showing that wireless radiation is certainly harmful, the agency, whether it's a school or it's a local municipality or if it's a state government, will point to the FCC guidelines and simply say, well, what we're doing is well within or below the FCC guidelines. But people need to understand these guidelines only take into account thermal or acute burning, and so they really are, frankly, relatively useless in terms of protecting the public health. People also need to understand that the California Medical Association passed a resolution in the end of 2014 stating just this, that in the resolution that our safety standards are inadequate to protect public health and that there are numerous peer-reviewed studies showing that wireless radiation can damage DNA, cause single and double-strand DNA breaks, and lead to a host of diseases, including cognitive problems, brain cancer, ADHD, and fertility issues.
Okay, that's one person who's a scientist in the field. And you heard what he said. There's more than 10,000 studies on the dangers of wireless. Why don't we know that? Why isn't this a major front page story? Why isn't Congress on top of this to protect us, especially the young children using cell phones now and laptops? But that's one. Now let's hear the second part of this from a different person.
We're talking about on your social media. Our producers spend hours each day not reading the old fake news headlines. You are our incredible reporters, so I want to get right back to it. John McCain recently diagnosed with a brain tumor, as you know, and we see other prominent figures in America like former Vice President Beau Biden, a son of former Vice President Beau Biden, who, as you know, died of brain cancer. But it's not just politicians. It happens to people across the country. And some studies have shown a link between brain cancer and cell phone use. So I wondered, when I saw what had happened with John McCain, if it could have anything to do with that. So I called in the expert here with me now to discuss California Brain Tumor Association. And we are the evidence. Bioinitiative.org, Kevin Modis. Kevin, the John McCain, is it any coincidence? Is there any way it's coincidence that the scar he has is like right here and this is all happening right here and that happens to be right where you put a cell phone?
Just like you said, Gina, the scar is right down his face, exactly where you would hold your cell phone. And you need to understand he had a glioblastoma. And while the wireless industry says there's no increase in brain tumors, so there's no problem with cell phones, the reality is there's a significant increase in glioblastomas. Unfortunately, they're very, very deadly.
So whether curing some source of brain cancer, they can come up with these statistics that say there's no increase in brain cancer, when you're saying there has been a dramatic increase in the one specifically related to cell phone radiation.
Yeah, and the glioblastomas have been related to cell phone use by a scientist and medical doctor, Leonard Hardell. And people can go to his blog, Hardell Blog, and he's one of the leading scientists, has a group that has been doing research for a long time and has significantly shown a relationship between cell phone use and these GBMs or glioblastomas. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the wireless industry says there hasn't been any increase in brain tumors. And for the overall head, there hasn't been an increase. But in the three areas of the brain that get the most cell phone radiation, okay, your frontal lobe, your temporal lobe, and your cerebellum, The increase is significant in a study that was done by USC all the way up for the 15 years before 2006. Now, that's up to 2006. Now, think about how much people have been using wireless since 2006.
Yeah, and your Bluetooth doesn't change this, right?
No, it doesn't, because it still transmits to the cell phone.
As much?
Not as much, but you still have a transmitter in your ear. And as one technician said, why don't you explain to him, your ear is a hole in your head, and those microwaves go right into your head.
So I don't really like to talk on my phone, and the reason is because I get a headache when I talk on my phone. And people get really frustrated with me that I almost refuse to talk on my cell phone. Unless it's an emergency with one of my children, I pretty much don't do it. And if I do it, I will use the speaker function. Am I safe?
Well, you're not safe, and you're a great example of neurological effects from wireless radiation. The same kind of neurological effects, the FCC, don't exist. And this is the big problem. The FCC regulates wireless radiation human exposure levels. And the fact is, the FCC has no one qualified to assess safety for us. Yet they're saying it's safe, and they've set a standard that's too high. It's a thermal standard. Thermal and above. If it doesn't heat you or burn you, it doesn't hurt you. And as you know, your phone doesn't heat or burn you, but yet you still have biological effects. People are getting neurological effects. People are getting cancer from wireless radiation. People are getting immune system problems. Mm-hmm. And fertility is affected, basically affecting all systems of the body. And people just go to that website you talked about, bioinitiative.org. This looks at 3,600 studies and breaks it down by different sections of the body and shows you there's definitely evidence that wireless radiation is very, very harmful and should be minimized rather than maximized, which the FCC is doing in concert with the wireless industry and their lobby group, CTIA.
But it's actually scarier than that, because even if you're not using a cell phone at all, they're putting towers up all over the country without your permission. You used to have to sign something, and you saw those little green tree-looking things that were cell towers, you know, and they if they were going to put them within a certain radius of your house, you had to sign off of them. Not the case anymore, tell us.
Yeah, so there's a new wireless technology, 5G. So right now we're at a lower frequency, like 1 to 3 gigahertz. This is now 24 to 90 gigahertz. Mm. Just to put that in perspective, 90 gigahertz is 90 billion electromagnetic waves per second hitting and going through your cells every second. That is far from natural. Your heart has a circuit, has electricity to it. Your brain has electricity to it. It's about 8 to 10 hertz. This is billions of times more than what's natural. And 5G is being forced on us. In California, SB 649 is going to make it so they can put one of these transmitters in front of your house. And 5G doesn't travel very well because it's very dense. And so they have to put a transmitter about every 2 to 10 homes. And they're not going to ask you about it. They're just going to put it in front of you, exempt from any health, safety, or environmental review.
On streetlights.
On streetlights, on poles in front of your house, on any kind of fixture that can get what they want. And it's not going to be your choice. There's not going to be any consent. And I got to tell you, it's not a very Republican thing to do. It's not a very American thing to do. And these bills are stripping away your constitutional rights to protect yourself and your families.
By the way, the woman in this clip is also a doctor. Now we're going to a very short minute and 24-second clip by another doctor, Dr. Devra, D-E-V-R-A, Davis.
I'm Dr. Devra Davis, and I'm here to talk with you today about the 5G that Environmental Health Trust is quite concerned about. This is a network that's being rolled out all over the country that will involve thousands of antennas. I love my devices as much as anyone else, but I don't want to put the health of my grandchildren at risk. I don't want to put them in harm's way. And we now know that the skin, our largest organ, does respond to 5G. And in fact, we have in our sweat ducts, they can act as antennas that can receive signals. Now, this has not been tested for safety. The fact that it can interact with our sweat ducts may have much more profound meanings for our overall health and well-being. The idea that we're going to saturate this country with a network that has never been tested is appalling. And I am joining with many other scientists from around the world now to express concerns and to say we must evaluate these things before we roll out the technology, no matter how attractive it is for us to have faster downloads.
Now, finally, here is the pro-G5 spokesperson. This is the immediate past president of the, or head of the Federal Communications Commission that oversees all of this, regulates all of it, and he comes directly from not one but two major lobbying groups lobbying on behalf of this technology. And here's how he's promoting it at a conference where the pro-industry and pro-G5 people are listening to everything he has to say. Listen to him.
The big game changer is that 5G will use much higher frequency bands than previously thought viable for mobile broadband and other applications. Such millimeter wave signals have physical properties that are both a limitation and a strength. They tend to travel best in narrow and straight lines, and they do not go through physical objects as well. But brilliant engineers have developed new antennas that can aim and amplify signals. Now, to make this work, the 5G build-out is going to be very infrastructure intensive, requiring massive deployment of small cells. I'm confident that the actions will lead to a cornucopia of unanticipated, innovative uses and will generate tens of billions of dollars in economic activity. And that's
it. You hear a man talking about the tens of billions of dollars, yet it has never been tested, not a single human study, and yet it's impacting people. And when it goes up in your neighborhood, California, that's the test ground. Then it'll go right across America. In New York City, almost every other building will have to have these on them. And you heard 90 billion pulses per second going through your body, and your heart has its own electromagnetic system, as does your brain and your central nervous system. Could you imagine the pandemic of neurological and nervous system disorders that this could create? All about greed. So I'll have more on this, but a heads up on that. We're taking a break and coming right back into part one of a five-part series on how do we get to where a relatively small group of individuals are now controlling our destiny and future in molecular biology, but before they got here, they had a really sordid past. And unlike other people who might make a condemnation of people's behavior, this is fully documented. Every statement you're about to hear is completely substantiated and historically accurate.
Drive.
In a highly symbolic gesture, the Rockefeller family will sell off its assets linked to fossil fuel companies.
A slump in global oil prices has Saudi Arabia rethinking its near total dependence on oil revenue.
We should be focusing on it, and we should be curbing our, you know, appetite for carbon-intensive products and services. But the problem is it's got a lot of room for debate.
Obviously, the Rockefellers are making this move as an environmental one, but also from an investment standpoint, this also makes plenty of business sense.
You can't simply carry on business the way you're doing it now. There is a price to carbon in their future.
What do you see as the biggest challenges in conservation?
The growing human population.
At the dawn of the 20th century, a new international order was emerging, one founded on oil. And by the end of the 20th century, that order was firmly established. Heating, transportation, industrial power, plastic manufacturing, pharmaceuticals. There is no facet of modern life that is not, one way or another, dependent on oil. But the rulers of this oligarchy, the Rockefellers at Standard Oil, the British Royals at BP, the Dutch Royals and the Rothschilds at Royal Dutch Shell, were not content with mere financial domination. The power that came with their near-total monopoly on the world's most important commodity was enormous, and they had no qualms about using that power to remake the world in their image. As we saw in How Big Oil Conquered the World, the impact of the oligarchs has been breathtaking. From the education system to the medical profession, from the Green Revolution to the Gene Revolution, from World War to the Gulf War, oil money has been used to shape every aspect of the world we live in. With the rise of the petrodollar in the 1970s, even the international monetary system itself rests on oil. But now, in the 21st century, it seems that the old order, the oil order, is finally coming to an end.
We begin looking at a new milestone in the growing campaign for divestment from the gas, oil, and coal companies that are fueling climate change. May Bouvey, executive director of 350.org, made the announcement just before our broadcast today.
Today we're announcing that as of today, total divestment commitments have passed the $3.4 trillion mark. That's $3.4 trillion of assets under management, now fossil-free.
In the oil and gas sector, we recognize the contribution of our activities and products to greenhouse gas emissions, which is why the OGCI was set up.
What began as a movement on U.S. college campuses has reached the skyscrapers of high finance.
Globally, nearly 200 institutions and thousands of individuals have moved a total of $50 billion in assets away from fossil fuels.
If we take our money, put it into renewables like solar panels, the world could be such a better place.
The masses, having identified the oligarchs and their destructive grip on the planet, see big oil waning and have begun to celebrate. To them, the promise of a post-carbon future represents the end of the oligarchy. What many do not realize, however, is that the oil order was never about oil. The oligarchs did not care about oil, but control. And, having long outgrown their financial dependence on the commodity that brought them their power and riches, they are at the forefront of this push for the post-carbon era. Now, the oligarchs are seeking to bring in a new international order, one in which their control is consolidated, their plan complete, their power unquestionable. One in which every aspect of human life, from energy to money to the very genome itself, is precisely ordered and technologically controlled. This is the story of what the oligarchs really desire and how they plan to achieve it. Dhaka, 1963. It's a day much like any other in Dhaka. The streets are crowded, dirty, squalid, smelly, and absolutely swarming with people, lying in the streets, coiled in the gutters. Into that swarm of people steps a most unlikely figure. Wearing his drip-dry suit and hugging his briefcase, he sticks out from the crowd. Surveying the scene, he shakes his head ever so slightly before remarking, half to himself and half to his traveling companion, "Well, that's the problem, isn't it?" It's a scene that has played itself out many times. A Western tourist overwhelmed by the bustling crowds of the Indian subcontinent. But this was no mere tourist passing time on his holiday. This was John D. Rockefeller III, grandson of oil baron John D. Rockefeller. And, armed with the unimaginable wealth, power, and influence that his family name bestowed on him, he was on a mission to do something about the problem of overpopulation. Rockefeller approached that mission as a representative of the Population Council, a group that he himself had founded in 1952 to address the problem in Dhaka and elsewhere. On its surface, the Population Council was a straightforward organization with a straightforward task: to support medical and scientific research into the question of the growing human population. But the dark history of the council and its guiding philosophy reveal Rockefeller's true interest in this problem and its ultimate solution. John D. Rockefeller III, or JDR3, as he was known to the constellation of researchers, businessmen, politicians, diplomats, and royals in the orbit of the Rockefeller family, had decided early on how to make proper use of the formidable money and power at his disposal, by controlling the population of the planet. In 1934, the then 28-year-old JDR3 had written a letter to his father, John D. Rockefeller Jr., about the Rockefeller Foundation's research into birth control and related questions, declaring, "I have come pretty definitely to the conclusion that it is the field in which I will be interested, for the present at least, to concentrate my own giving." JDR3 was nothing if not a man of his word. After commissioning a Rockefeller Foundation fact-finding mission to Asia to report on the threat of the growing third world population, he organized a conference of the top medical and demographic researchers of the era to discuss, as the very title of the meeting termed it, population problems. From that meeting emerged the idea for an organization, the Population Council, to guide the development of the burgeoning field of population and fertility research. JDR3 personally donated $1.35 million of his own money to found the council and provide its initial operating expenses. Like his father and grandfather before him, Rockefeller had learned to use philanthropy and largesse as a mask for his true intention, control. But that mask slipped when he penned a draft of the council's charter revealing the organization's true purpose. The council, according to JDR3, would promote research and apply existing knowledge to help develop such changes in the attitudes, habits, and environmental pressures affecting the life of human beings, so that within every social and economic grouping, parents who were above the average in intelligence, quality of personality, and affection will tend to have larger than average families. Thomas Perrin, the former Surgeon General of the United States and Council co-founder, warned against including such a blunt admission in the Council's mission statement. "Such questions arise as the following," he warned. "Who is to determine the parents who are above average in affection? Also, who would decide the persons having better than average personality? Frankly, the implications of this, while I know they were intended to have a eugenic implication, could readily be misunderstood as a Nazi master race philosophy. I have, therefore, recast this paragraph." The line was dropped from the final version of the charter. In truth, however, that sentence had not been written by JDR3 himself. Instead, it had been copied word for word from the back cover of Eugenical News, the central publication of the American eugenics movement. This was no mere accident. Frederick Osborne, one of the co-founders of the council and its first president after Rockefeller stepped down in 1957, was also the president of the American Eugenics Society. When the Population Council was founded, both Osborne and the American Eugenics Society he directed formally moved their operations into the Council's New York office, with the Eugenics Society now taking its funding directly from Rockefeller's Population Council grant. The Population Council was the Eugenics Society under another name. Eugenics. This was the guiding vision of JDR3 and the Rockefeller family's philanthropy. A vision that cast the Rockefellers and their fellow oligarchs as superior families, fit by very virtue of their wealth and success to guide the course of world events. The power to determine who was fit to breed and who was too poor to pass on their genes.
Eugenics is basically a movement among the elite to eradicate what they deem the inferior classes. And that's the inferior social classes, racial classes, ethnic classes, more or less everyone who isn't up to their standards. And after eradicating those classes, what they aim to do is genetically engineer themselves to such a high level that the remaining population that they permit to exist beneath them will never have the power to overthrow them, essentially, the end of history. So the term itself was coined by Galton, and it essentially means well-born. The idea is kind of a mix of a bunch of ideas that were circulating around the 1850s. So if you go back to, say, Mendel was studying hereditary characteristics in pea plants, and he was able to determine that certain characteristics were being passed on and that these things could be determined and essentially predicted. And also at the same time, now you have Spencer, who's talking about the survival of the fittest, with the same kind of idea, the same thread running through there, that there are genetic characteristics that exist that would make one species, one plant or animal more fit than another and more capable of surviving. Also, of course, you had Darwin's work at the time, Origin of Species, and kind of maps this process by which genetic material is passed along, and evolution results through this process. So Galton is essentially taking all of these ideas, and he was kind of known for observing and identifying patterns. And what he essentially did was started to come up with this concept, this idea, that through studying human characteristics, they could, if they chose to, breed superior human beings.
Obsessed with breeding and family heredity, the eugenicists believed that it was not merely physical characteristics like weight or height that were determined by one's family line, but social characteristics like intelligence or conscientiousness or even criminality. If you were poor, it's because you come from poor stock. If you're criminal, it's because your family line is criminal. And if you're a Rockefeller or a Rothschild or a royal, you are rich and successful because your family was destined for fortune and success. The pseudoscientific trappings of this 19th century eugenic philosophy may have been new, but in fact the idea is as old as human civilization itself. People have always been taught to believe that their rulers are special, a class apart, members of a family specially chosen to rule over the masses. Whether literal descendants of the gods, like the pharaohs of Egypt or the emperors of Japan, or members of families specially chosen by God to reign over their kingdoms, like the monarchs of Europe, the right to rule over others was something passed down through family trees. The commoners, meanwhile, knew their place. Not being born of royal blood, they entered the world as serfs, worked the land for the benefit of the noble class, and, if they were lucky, had children of their own to repeat the cycle for another generation. But the breakdown of medieval feudalism gave rise to a newly wealthy merchant class. The development of the scientific method challenged centuries of religious dogma. The spread of Enlightenment philosophy led to the toppling of monarchs and the rise of democracy. And the Industrial Revolution paved the way for the rise of the robber barons and the creation of vast new family fortunes. By the late 19th century, as the oligarchs in America and Europe began to consolidate their wealth, a new justification for elite rule of society was needed. One that discarded with outdated appeals to supernatural order and seemed to rest on a bedrock of science. An idea that could explain how nouveau riche upstarts like the Rockefellers and Rothschilds had risen to positions of prominence in society alongside the old royal dynasties of Europe. Eugenics fit the bill perfectly. The answer was in their genes.
Well, I think this eugenic idea that comes about of survival of the fittest almost gives a scientific excuse for some of the most inhumane and horrific actions that have ever been journeyed by humanity and then manifested. So the idea of controlling people through controlling reproduction and reproductive capability and access to mates and stuff like this is an idea that's thousands of years old. So eugenics, when it came around, you know, in a strong form in the late 1800s, where you've got people like the Darwins, the Wedgwoods, and the Huxleys, specifically T.H. Huxley, Thomas H. Huxley, was known as Darwin's bulldog. So these ideas of eugenics really take on, you know, a new life of their own at the end of the 1800s and coming into the 1900s. These ideas were embraced by the same families that were these robber barons that were being funded by the Rothschild banking network, also the Fabian Socialist Society, which again had a lot of the same movers and shakers as these people who were higher ups in the British Empire. So when it reared its head in the 1920s and 30s and these forced sterilization campaigns, whereas, you know, if they felt that you had a low IQ or that you had some congenital disease that would be passed on, that you didn't have the right to marry and have children.
Eugenics, of course, was pseudoscience. When Galton and his fellow travelers began developing the theory, the identification of the actual mechanism of heredity, including genes and DNA, was nearly 100 years away. Instead, they used catch-all terms with no definition, like feeble-mindedness, to diagnose poverty or criminality, claiming it was caused by defective germplasm. They used phrenology to try to determine the physical expression of alcoholism or low intelligence. Even the most famous works of the eugenics era, like Henry Goddard's study of the Kallikak family, were roundly discredited and even repudiated by their authors.
It's 100% pseudoscientific. It's absolutely arbitrary. The characteristics that they're looking for, something like feeble-mindedness, is something that is not only not scientific, it can essentially be described in any way that the person who is observing wants it to be described. So feeble-minded could mean that maybe you stutter, so then you're feeble-minded. Maybe you're shy, so you're feeble-minded. Maybe they just don't like the way you act, so you're feeble-minded.
But the idea was an infectious one. Like all the most enticing pseudoscience, it explained so much with so little effort. It appealed to the vanity of the researchers, usually hailing from successful and wealthy families themselves, and it gave an excuse for social engineering on a scale never before dreamed of. When eugenics crossed the Atlantic, spreading from the rarefied British countryside of Galton and his cohorts to the rocky shores of America, it hit ambitious young researchers like Charles Davenport with hurricane force. A Harvard-trained zoologist who had grown up in a strict, puritanical family of New England Congregationalists, Davenport's authoritarian father was obsessed with genealogy, tracing the family tree all the way back to his Anglo-Saxon forebears in 1086. When the younger Davenport discovered Galton's writing while working in a biological laboratory on Long Island, he found his purpose in life. As he later told the American Breeders Association, which became an important ally in his eugenicist cause, "Society must protect itself. As it claims the right to deprive the murderer of his life, so also it may annihilate the hideous serpent of hopelessly vicious protoplasm." With the proselytizing fervor of a religious
convert, we will pick this up with part two. There are five parts. So for all of you who are excited by the new genetic possibilities of the future, understand it's the same families who are controlling molecular biology, funding all the research. And what is their real game here? You'll be hearing that. Everything that's being stated is 100% accurate and has been verified. But we are just beginning to show how deep their own interest in controlling the human population is. And I want to thank James Corbett for his outstanding scholarship and reporting on this issue. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.